Welcome to The Quantum Pod, a podcast by Zapata. On today's episode, I sit down with two Zapatistas to talk about quantum machine learning, why it's exciting, and how businesses can get started. All right, so I have with me in today's Quantum Pod, Luis Serrano, who is a quantum application scientist, and Brian Delabata, who is a senior ML ops engineer. Welcome to the Quantum Pod.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So I got to ask, and there's two of you, so this might be a little bit more tricky than normal, but what does your Quantum Pod look like? Describe the atmosphere, maybe what's the sound like? What does it look like? Luis, if you wanna start, and then we'll go to Brian.
Yeah, well, one thing that I loved, I guess, since I was born is just writing on walls. So I actually, my dream office is just where everything is a board. And I have close to that. I have one entire wall where I put some whiteboard, big stickers. And so I like writing there whenever I have an idea. And that's pretty much it. I like to put some music when I work sometimes.
For me, I like to always code to baseball. So I usually have Cubs game on. They have a lot of day games, especially on Fridays. So I always get the roar of the crowd as you're coding. Done that as a kid. I grew up watching Cubs all the time, so it's always been like the perfect white noise.
Is there a correlation between how they do and how your code compiles?
That's a good question. Yeah, they're doing well right now. If that's any indication.
Great. So that's awesome. I love that visual of one wall plastered with whiteboards and drawings, and the other wall's got a big flat screen TV with Cubs game going. So the next question, these are rapid fire questions, so short answers, is what do you like most about quantum computing? We'll go reverse order. So Brian, you first.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the novelty it makes it a super interesting field. Combined with the fact that the digital computing, classical computing revolution changed so abruptly our lives. I grew up playing video games all the time. I was amazed at even in the span of like my teenage years, how much that could advance and change. And I've been in computing, machine learning, data science, app development my whole career. So I've really got an opportunity to see how much it's all changed in the classical realm. When I was in grad school, quantum computing was a pipe dream, and like I was something that I kind of like rolled my eyes at, like, oh, that's never going to happen. And now it's like there's a whole industry on making this an actual thing, and so it's really exciting to be a part of.
Yeah, for me, similar. I mean, I think it's fascinating that something as volatile as a qubit can be turned into something that helps us make huge computations. I think that's fascinating, and I think it's fascinating that we are living it, right? We're living history, because basically it's like when computers were a big room and they would be able to add 1 + 1, and that's it. Like we are living that process, right? But I gotta say that the coolest thing I found of quantum computers is the way they can do one thing that is so hard for classical computers. Classical computers have such a hard time generating random numbers. As a matter of fact, they can't. They just generate pseudo random numbers with hugely complicated procedures, whereas a quantum computer can very easily, just by measuring, can generate a random thing. So I think that's pretty useful if we harness it correctly, and also kind of unexpected.
Yeah, cool. And this next question is, I guess, somewhat related, less about what you personally find interesting and more, what is the most revolutionary aspect of quantum computing? Luis.
Yeah, there's many things. I mean, I think we always think of speed, and speed is definitely important. You can do the fact that you can sort of carry out many computations at the same time. That's with an asterisk, right? Because you have to take care of measurements and everything. But I found actually very interesting how some probability distributions are very, very easy to model on a quantum computer, and hard for a classical, which makes it in some way they search better in some spaces than classical computers, and I think that's surprising.
Yeah, and Brian?
Yeah, I think for me, like my graduate work was in a lot of computational physics, studying like electron transport in semiconductors. I've been in this field for about 6 months. I'm just thinking if I were to refactor that code into a quantum computer code in a way that, in a fault tolerant quantum computer per se, all of the issues that we had with scale go away essentially. And like all the things that we had to do, all the menial labor to try and simplify Hamiltonians and given patterns to make this work, kind of fall by the wayside if you have a fault tolerant quantum computer. And so I'm really excited at like the ability to simulate natural phenomenon in a way that we haven't come close to being able to before.
Super cool. Yeah. So, all right, with the fun ritual questions out of the way, let's dive into what we're here to talk about, which is machine learning, and more specifically, quantum enterprise machine learning. The first thing we wanted to talk about is that possible enterprise customers who are looking to get into quantum machine learning might be pleasantly surprised when they find out that they have some of the needed prereqs for QML, or just find out what some of those prereqs are. And so maybe you two could walk me through what are some of those prereqs that might already exist, or maybe even some of the ones that don't exist. I'm not sure who wants to take this first, but.
Yeah, I think in terms of prereqs for QML, there's going to be a lot of overlap with what you see in ML, like in terms of the ML flow, the ML ops, the whole cycle around machine learning management. I think you're going to see very similar takes with QML. It's just that the algorithms are going to change, but the way you manage data, the way you manage models, the way you version control all of that, that pipeline is largely going to stay the same. I think one of our goals is to make sure that what we build can plug in easily to pre-existing infrastructure, but also be a standalone service as well.
Yeah, and I think one needs to know algorithms are not going to be fully quantum. We're always going to use, most of it will be classical, right? So that part stays, you know, the handling the data, processing the results, all that is the same. And so what customers need is to really identify what part of the classical algorithm is a bottleneck and be able to know what kind of bottlenecks are good for quantum computers, or what kind of bottlenecks are doable with a quantum computer. And when it comes to understanding the algorithms, it's very much the same understanding on machine learning, right? Machine learning, what is it? You have the output that you want, and then you tune in your parameters in your model to get the output that you want slowly using some methods. Quantum computing is the same thing. You just have a different architecture that just spits out answers, and you tune it so that it gives you the output that you want. So conceptually, it's the same thing. And many times when you learn machine learning, you start with the model as a black box, and you only learn how to tune the parameters, and that's it. And then you slowly learn it until you master it. And I think with quantum is the same thing. You can start as a black box, know how to tune parameters, and then slowly start understanding. And I think that's sort of the one good pathway to learn.
Yeah, awesome. And some of the prereqs are, like you're saying, that making sure that you have the classical down and having your ML infrastructure ready with your data pipelines and your version control. This brings up the point that a well-known analyst we were talking to said, which is that some enterprise tech leaders are wanting to get into quantum, and the analyst is saying, well, have you maxed out your classical yet? And so, Brian, maybe you can talk a little bit about this and this idea that your classical needs to get maxed out before you dive into quantum.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the literature in classical ML, like it's evolving and changing, maybe not at the speed of QML, but like changing very significantly. And so it might take a long time between research proving a point and having that end up in your ML pipeline. I think it's kind of like a constant vigilance, making sure that you're up to date, and maybe also something that we provide to our clients and customers, because we need to be aware of those, I guess, headwinds as much as we need to be in the QML side. I think we're going to be bringing on more ML engineers focused on those regions as well to make sure that we're, with our quantum algorithms, we're benchmarking those against the best in class classical algorithms as well. So that it's almost a moving target in terms of the accuracies or the efficiencies we want to gain, because it's such an evolving field.
That's true. I do believe that Zapata has a couple open positions for ML engineers that we're looking to fill. So,
if I may, I think, yeah, I think it's not, shouldn't wait until you max out the classical, because for most technologies, if you wait until you max out the previous technology, you are too late in the game. I think what companies should do is they should be ready. They should start thinking about quantum. Some things will happen now, and they may find some advantages that they weren't expecting, because when they say maxed out, they probably have some metrics in mind, and there's some that they maybe haven't looked at. But the other reason is that if you start exploring quantum, you may get results right now, or you may just set the stage for when quantum computers are have great performance. And if you start setting the stage then, that means you have to sort of rethink everything that you've done. So I recommend to start getting into quantum now.
Yeah, maybe maxed out wasn't the right word. I think that the idea was more you need to have those pipelines and data structures in place so that you're able to more easily bring quantum into your workflow. To expound on that point a bit further, yes, it's true that, as Brian says, classical computing and classical ML are ever-evolving fields, so maxing them out can change and shift from day to day. However, like we've talked about in episode 2 with Jonathan, there are many parallels between machine learning and quantum computing, and especially between machine learning and quantum machine learning. These prereqs for starting with QML, like version control or models and data, pipeline, talent and workforce even, and especially benchmarks, all make it significantly easier to get into QML if you already have those in place. If you don't have that infrastructure in place, it will be an uphill battle. As Luis just said, though, that doesn't necessarily mean you shouldn't fight that battle. You just need to prepare for it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it will always be a hybrid approach. Like, you'll never go full quantum. You know, you always still need the classical piece.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Some things classical computers do much better. Anything that's deterministic or adding or processing numbers, you're not going to go for that quantum computer, which will reply with a probability space, right? So for those things, you'll always use a classical computer, but it's for the bottlenecks that you'll be able to use a quantum computer.
Yeah, this brings up an interesting point, which is that if most of your algorithm or a good portion of your algorithm is still going to be classical and it's not all going to be quantum, how much do you actually need to know about the quantum that's going on behind the scenes in order to actually use this?
Yeah, it's surprising, but actually you don't need to know that much quantum physics. It's great if you know it, and it's great if you learn it as you go, but you need to know some rules of the game. So if you know some things that happen, even if you don't know exactly what's in the background, that is useful. And if you know how to turn the knobs and how to tweak this, and you more like get used to it, the way, for example, you know, we get used to gravity way before we understand it, and that kind of stuff, I think that's the most useful thing. And then if you learn some packages, some packages of code that work in a similar way to the traditional packages that you would use, then you can start already sort of deploying quantum models and using them for solving your problems.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. We want, I think that's one of our goals too, is to make sure it's as user friendly as possible. I guess you can use the example of PyTorch and TensorFlow as classical libraries, where you don't necessarily need to know how backpropagation works in order to use it and have it be effective for your team, have it translate to actual, you know, business insights. So if we can kind of replicate that idea and continue with black box where possible, I think that's a huge win for us and our clients. And then if it necessitates further quantum physics or understanding of quantum. I mean, maybe that's also an interesting foray, a more education type piece, but I don't see it necessitating that.
Yeah, and there's probably a difference here between how much quantum you need for quantum machine learning versus quantum computing, right? If you've got this black box quantum machine learning model that you're tweaking knobs, you need to know less than if you want to exploit quantum interference to build the next Shor's algorithm.
Absolutely.
There's certainly varying degrees of complexity, Shor's being the one that I'm still trying to wrap my head around to some degree. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that's spot on. Because if you think about like the work that's going on in computational chemistry or some of the more physical sciences, it's a much different language, different vocabulary, much more scientific based. Where with QML, it seems much more phenomenological, I guess.
Yeah, it's not that different from where how it works in the classical land, right? You can start doing machine learning without being an expert in statistics because you just get used to the models, right? If you want to develop new models, then you probably have to be have a solid knowledge, which is the same if you want to develop then a new quantum machine learning model, then maybe you do have to know a lot of stuff. But if you want to work with the ones that exist, know how they work and apply them to solve your problems, then yeah, you don't need that much previous knowledge.
Yeah. It sounds like the biggest chunk of knowledge that you need here is what models or what quantum machine learning models are best for what types of problems so that you can spot the use cases within your own workflow to bring these into production.
Yeah.
Awesome. So once you've spotted this use case that you want to build, you actually have to deploy the model and build it up from whatever basic form it is. And so maybe, Brian, if you could walk us through the life cycle of a model, that'd be great.
Sure. Yeah. So it's very similar to a software development life cycle. There's a life cycle to a machine learning algorithm. So you might start with getting a data set or access to certain data. You'll always have an exploratory phase where you want to see what's going on in the data. What are the different types? Is it clean data? Is there a lot of munging you got to do? You know, there's always like the adage of 95% of a data scientist's job is munging and cleaning data. And that's certainly true. So from there, you can start looking at what's called feature engineering, which of these aspects of the data are important to your particular use case. Maybe it's not necessarily exactly in the data itself, but it's some kind of transformation of the data. You might map it to a cleaner format or normalize it or any of those sorts of things. From there, you can start looking at which algorithms might be most beneficial. If you're if you're doing supervised learning versus unsupervised learning, it's going to be different potential schemes. You can start training your data against one of those selected models. You can there's lots of tools out there for hyperparameter tuning to make sure that you're getting the best model, best bang for the buck without actually having to go in and tune those knobs yourself. A lot of automatic tooling for that. Once you have a model that you want to push to production, that's really like this is where like the DevOps piece, similar with software. If you want to push to a production server that's constantly maintaining users, you got to be very careful about how you do it. You don't want any downtime. There's a whole suite of testing you can do before you do so. You want version control. If your model is trained against a set of data, you want to know what that set of data is. So there's data version control as well. The model could change. It could drift with new data. So making sure that you have a collection, a good understanding of all those different pieces in place, and your ops pipeline supports all of that. From there, the model is a living thing, just like code is a living thing. You're always constantly updating it, pushing changes, tweaking. The model is the same way, and so making sure that your deployment is equally automated and battle tested. It's just as important to all of that.
And I would guess that modularity helps a lot here. Like if you're able to update and maintain just one specific section rather than have to redeploy the whole thing, that helps a lot.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. And so I guess, like, especially in software development, you can think of it that way, where you can have specific features in the same way with machine learning. You could potentially have a change that maybe you find that a better hyperparameter selection is better. You can tweak that or change bits and pieces of it. Yeah.
I don't have a ton of experience with the data mungeon that you were talking about, but there was one time where I had a whole CSV file, very large, like a couple gigabytes CSV file. Everything looked perfectly fine, you know, at first glance, but I kept running into an error, and it was one cell that was missing, completely crashed the whole thing. So yeah, I know the pain.
Yep. Anytime you're going from, especially like a human entered data format into something that the computers are very brittle. If it doesn't satisfy exactly what the computer wants, you're going to hit an error. In the past, I've worked on munging US addresses that were human entered. And so like there are whole sets of rules engines that you can apply. Actually, there ends up being a lot of open source utilities because this is a common enough problem. I think US address was the pip package that we were able to use for that. But it's a lot of time and energy and a lot of work to get one of those things up as well as maintain them.
Yeah, US addresses are one of those things that is hard for a computer and hard for a human.
Yeah.
Yep. So I'm curious, does this life cycle change at all if you're looking at just adding in one specific quantum part that's a quantum boost? Like, let's say you've already got a full model that you just want to replace one part with a quantum enhanced part. Does that change a lot? Does that change a little bit? What does that do?
Yeah, I think it's very dependent on the infrastructure that's already in place. There's levels of maturity to your infrastructure. Just like there's levels of maturity to a model or a software stack. One of our goals is to make sure, because I think this will be a big use case as well, having your quantum or quantum classical hybrid components in parallel with pre-existing architecture. And that's one of the things that we're actively engineering around, making sure that we can kind of plug in as needed to different data streams. The data can be replicated and passed along to the quantum component while maintaining the stream to the active classical component. But definitely a key for us to succeed. Yeah.
I should explain why in my last question I asked specifically about using a quantum boost for your machine learning algorithms. That reason being that some of the most exciting advancements in QML have been in the form of algorithms that give a quantum boost to existing classical algorithms. And this isn't just our opinion, we're also hearing from customers that this is exciting because it means a good amount of their existing classical infrastructure can be used to get the algorithm 99% of the way there, but then quantum can come along and boost it the rest of the way. This also goes back to the idea of maxing out classical first. If instead of your classical infrastructure getting you 99% there, it only gets to 80%, the extra 1% boost from quantum won't be enough to get you up to even where properly applied classical can get you. Here's Luis to explain more about some other reasons QML is likely one of the first places to see real quantum advantage.
Well, one thing is we've seen advantages in places like generative ML. Right, and this goes back to the I was talking before about generating random numbers. We've seen that when it comes to modeling distributions, quantum algorithms show an advantage in the practice so far in finding better distributions. And now, so far, generative models have been used when you associate them with sort of fun applications like generating faces or images or music, etc. But something that's very innovative is generating solutions to problems, right? You can take a bunch of, if you want to solve a problem, you can take a bunch of solutions that you generate classically and say, hey, quantum computer, give me stuff that looks a lot like these solutions. And turns out that if you do it properly, you found like solutions to our problems, for example, portfolio optimization, which is where it comes to QAO, for example. It's exactly that. You find a bunch of, you want to find the best portfolio, right? You want to find the best assets, the best way to combine assets to get the best gain with the minimum amount of risk in the stock market. And you can generate a bunch of solutions to this in with a classical algorithm. And then you give them to a quantum generative model, and the quantum generative model, without knowing what problem it's solving, it just says, hey, look, a lot of data looks like the data you gave me. And we've seen improvements for that. So I think that's one reason that we believe that generative model is one of the places where we're going to find a quantum advantage in practice.
And this QEO is our quantum enhanced optimization.
Quantum enhanced optimization, correct.
And if anyone listening to this is interested in learning more, we'll have a link to that paper in the show notes that you can go check out. Mm-hmm. But Brian, I believe there's also not just this optimization, but like what Luis was saying with image generation with our QCAN, if you want to tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. Yeah. Maybe just as a little background on the classical side, what's called generative adversarial network, a GAN, is a pair of neural nets, classical neural nets, one being a discriminator and one being a generator. And essentially, you can train one to beat the other, and then train the other to get up to speed with the other. So you can have these kind of inverse operations of given a set of data, I can discriminate it. I can say this is a picture of a cat, and now I can train my generator to generate pictures of cats. And so, one of our most recent QML research papers was on basically adding a quantum component into the generator to improve into the discriminator to improve the quality of the generated images. One of the avenues that we're, very focused on is generative modeling. One of the things that I think is really interesting in this space is it's very difficult to go from the output of a classical neural net to the input. There's a lot of non-linearities. It's very difficult to know once I get passed through this layer of my neural net what my data is. There's no inverse of the operation. In quantum computing, that largely goes away. A unitary transformation on my quantum state into another state can be completely reversed by running what's called the adjoint of the circuit. So I wonder if there's, rather than having two parallel architectures that are trained against each other, I wonder if there's a way to, I guess, exploit that advantage of quantum machine learning to make this a much more elegant architecture, or remove the architecture in that case.
Really interesting. And There's sort of a common thread between these two algorithms, both the QEO and the QCAN, which is that they're both just, you're taking one part of an overall algorithm and replacing it with quantum. The rest of it is still, it's all classical. And so you see this effect of, it's nice because you can boost pre-existing state-of-the-art classical algorithms to use quantum.
Yeah, and furthermore, it works right now, right? If you were to do it on a classical computer, it'll still work, right? Or a quantum-inspired algorithm, which is quantum by nature, but works on classical computers, or with a purely quantum algorithm. So you not only get the results right now, but you also get the potential for the future. And also, you kind of gain on all sides, because if generative models get better, you win, and if quantum generative models get better, then you win. So it's kind of the best of both worlds.
Yeah, I think you can kind of think of it as another piece in the repertoire. They can be combined. Doesn't need to be a standalone thing. They can plug in nicely with one another, especially in the NISQ era, where we're limited to tens or dozens of qubits before we reach this holy land of fault-tolerant quantum computers.
These points that Luis and Brian just made are especially exemplified by our QEO algorithm, because it doesn't need to use quantum computing. The underlying idea, which is to use a generative model to enhance optimization, also works with classical generative models. We think that quantum will allow for better performance, but the ability for a company to start using this method now and then swap in a quantum component later is extremely powerful. That power is only amplified with Orchestra, which is purpose-built for this sort of swapping in and out. Brian, I wanted to ask you, knowing what you know now about quantum computing, if you went back, because you come from, you've worked at a big bank in the past, if you went back into a big bank and wanted to bring this knowledge with you, what would you bring back with what you know now?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, you can kind of see it in the financial industry already. You see people that are taking bigger bets on quantum and others not so much, with others waiting to see kind of see how it all fleshes out beforehand. I think there's a lot of potential advantage in going that first route of being like the early adopters and all that, but it's also a huge capital investment. So I understand if you're a financial industry, it's not to do research, it's to make money. So I think what that means for us, for our perspective, is we want to be able to support both. We want to be doing leading research, but we also want to make sure that we boil this down into meaningful insights or meaningful algorithms or meaningful tools for entities that are just more interested in improving an algorithm without necessarily why it works better or that it's quantum or classical or quantum classical. We want to make sure that we can plug in parallel or as a standalone. We want to make sure that it's easy to deploy. Those are the focuses for us so that we can be a benefit to any of those entities in the future.
Great. And Luis, I wanted to ask you, are there any closing thoughts? Because you've got a great YouTube channel that I'll put a link to that in the show notes too, where you teach people about machine learning. Are there any closing thoughts that you'd like to teach people listening to the pod?
I mean, my closing thoughts are start learning it now. Don't go in the order of first learning all of AI and then learning all of quantum. Start learning them at the same time and seeing the similarities. And if you're interested in quantum, go for the hard stuff. I mean, and it's not in the sense of a challenge or anything. Go because if you want to find advantages on a quantum computer, it's not necessary to go for the strengths of a classical computer. They do very well what they do well. And what you want to do is, you know, go for the weaknesses of the quantum computer. You can start analyzing what are the things that classical computers are not so good at or not so fast. And that's why we go for generative models and unsupervised learning, because that's what seems to be one of the hardest things for a classical computer. So yeah, go for that and enjoy the learning process. It's always fun to learn new things.
Awesome. Well, Luis, Brian, thank you both for coming into the Quantum Pod. We can shut off the Cubs game and erase the whiteboards now.
Thanks, Ethan.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode about the world of quantum machine learning, why it's a good place to start for businesses, and how QML can offer boosts to classical algorithms. One of my big takeaways is that quantum machine learning will always be a hybrid approach, which makes it a great place to bring in existing classical ML expertise. If you found this episode interesting, please share this podcast with the hashtag QuantumPod and tell us what you liked about it for a chance to win a free Zapata Computing t-shirt. Be sure to like the podcast wherever you listen to it, subscribe, and maybe even leave a review if you're feeling generous. Until next time, this is Ethan Hansen reminding you to stay cool as a qubit.